This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Major League Baseball returned Thursday with the Washington Nationals taking on the New York Yankees. Baseball fans have been long awaiting the 2020 season. All the way back in January, the Chicago Cubs held their annual off-season event.
From the Cubs convention in Chicago, Illinois.
There were star players discussing the coming season, autograph sessions, and also a late-night TV-style show.
Spring baseball in Chicago, to me, was one of my favorite things.
The host wasn't a random comedian flown in for the evening. It was actually former Chicago Cubs pitcher and two-time All-Star Ryan Dempster.
Because being a pitcher, I felt like it was the one time a year we kind of had a little bit of an advantage, you know? It's still cold out. The hitters don't like the ball in their hands on the inside, right? The center field cameras aren't calibrated yet.
Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story.
When you signed up for improv classes, did people recognize you?
First class, no. Second class, when I got into level two, they started to be known that I did play, and they're just like, why are you here? Did you fall on financial hardship?
No, Ryan Dempster, who, according to Baseball Reference, made $89 million in his 16-year MLB career, has not fallen on financial hardship. But for those who have really known him, this new career makes a lot of sense. Take his childhood babysitter.
She was like, you know, when I found out you were a baseball player, I was like, oh, okay. But then when I found out you started to do stand-up comedy afterwards, I was like, oh, I totally get it.
Growing up in Gibson's British Columbia near Vancouver, Ryan Dempster landed a pretty sweet part-time job.
I worked at a video store when I was in high school, and one of my perks was I got to take as many movies home on a Friday and Saturday night as I wanted. And so me and my brothers, it was always like, oh, let's get this or let's get this. And, you know, UHF was one that we always would take home that night and watch it.
Channel 62 has the lowest ratings in the history of television.
What they need, you know, and then as we got older, you started getting into Mike Myers and Jim Carrey, and we'd watch them over and over, and we barely talked like normal to each other. It was always some sort of movie line quote. It was pretty funny, actually.
But it was Ryan's father who introduced him to the entertainer who would inspire Ryan's second act.
There would be nights where I'd be watching a hockey game or something late. I'd come crawling to the couch with him, and he'd be watching Johnny Carson.
I missed last night. I had a terrible head cold, and I've got more chemicals in me right now than the Love Canal.
And I was just like, oh, this is awesome. And then I just got hooked.
Now, it's not like from that moment forward, Ryan Dempster was set on becoming the next Johnny Carson or hosting his own late night TV show. Not back then. Not yet. Ryan was focused on a career in baseball. He had a strong right arm. And in 1995, about a month after his 18th birthday, he was drafted by the Texas Rangers. By the age of 21, he was in the big leagues, pitching for the Florida Marlins. But he brought his sense of humor to the job.
I was the guy that was always trying to figure out a way to keep it light. I don't know if it was because as a starting pitcher, I had 4 days off in between. So it was a lot of free time. But I always saw the value and the importance of laughing a little bit. You know, we'd land somewhere at 3 a.m. and I'm going to grab a microphone from the bus driver and play tour guide.
Oh, man. Wait, can you give me an example of one of your favorite tours to give?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to New York City. Now, we want to remind everybody, New York City is the place that never sleeps. That's right, the city that never sleeps, the Big Apple. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't sleep either. Okay, we are professional baseball players. You have a duty to do. That's to go out there and perform on the field. But
during his rookie season on a struggling Marlins team, Ryan had to learn an important lesson.
I remember we were in Houston.
The Marlins were losing badly to the Astros. Ryan was on the bench with some other players, including a fellow starting pitcher.
We're all kind of huddled around, and he told a really funny joke. Probably because earlier I was telling a joke and I started it. And I look down the bench and my eye line is with Jim Leland, who's our manager. And he's put out, we're terrible. Like we ended up losing 108 games that year. I think we're 54-108 or something like that. And he always smoked cigarettes in the dugout. And he took this big drag off a cigarette. He just chucked it out on the field and he walked down the tunnel.
After the game, Ryan and his teammates were in the locker room when they heard manager Jim Leland approaching.
He wore metal spikes, which I thought was like so awesome that your manager's, he's ready to take you out of the game and put himself in if he's like that mad, you know? And you just hear this like, when the doors just kick open. If I ever see another one of you pitcher laughing when we're getting our ass kicked, I'll have you out of here so fast your head will spin. And he unleashes on us.
Wow.
Like over and over and over. And then he'd stop. He'd be like, guys, listen, I'll lose. I'll go 0-162 with you. No problem, but not like that. You're not going to laugh when we're out there getting our tails whacked around. You better learn to have respect. So I'm just so embarrassed. And then he had the best line ever was after the leaving the clubhouse and coming back in five times on the fifth time, he said, if I come back out here and there's anybody in this locker room, then I'm going to call the cops and have you arrested for impersonating Major League Baseball players. So good. Just so good. I don't even know if I showered. I was out of there so fast. I hid from him for like 4 days.
So rookie Ryan Dempster was learning when it was and wasn't time to joke. And he also learned who to leave alone when they were having a bad game.
And, you know, you got other guys on the team who can strike out and they come back to the bat rack and then they sit on the bench and then you just walk over and you're just like, hey, dude, are you sure you're a left-handed hitter? You know,
Ryan went 1-4 his rookie season, but the next year he finished 7-8. Tying him for the second most wins on the team. In his third MLB season, he made the All-Star team for the first time. And in his fourth season, on a trip to Boston to play the Red Sox, Ryan would make a very different debut. Ryan was scheduled to start the first game of the series for the Marlins. It would be one of his first times pitching at Fenway Park.
So aren't you nervous?
Yeah, but it's like nobody, like we're with the Florida Marlins. No, they don't even know we have a team in Florida. Like we're like nobody's.
And the night before he was going to start against the Red Sox at Fenway Park, Ryan Dempster, his dad, and two of his teammates stopped by a comedy club at Faneuil Hall.
We kind of realized, hey man, it's open mic night. This is cool. And I just said, I'm going to go do this. And I didn't tell anybody and I just went over, talked to the manager and said, hey, I'm Ryan Dempster, you know, pitcher with the Marlins. I'm in town. I got a couple of teammates. Any chance you could let me get up there for a little bit? He was like, get the out of here. And I was like, no, I am. And he goes, oh, yeah, for sure you can. And then he introduced me as tomorrow night's starting pitcher. I sweated like crazy. I was way more nervous than the next day at Fenway Park.
Ryan went on stage. He talked about his trip to Boston.
I was like, yeah, we did this tour with me and my dad, saw the big dig, and everybody cheered the big dig like it was some sort of spectacular moment, you know? Like the Red Sox had won the World Series was the equivalent. And then they laughed a little bit, and then nobody threw any tomatoes at me.
Ryan and the Marlins lost the next day. He can't tell you too many details about the game. He says his memory works in unusual ways.
I don't even know what day of the week trash day is, but if you want me to quote Austin Powers for days, it's just like it's nonstop. Well, the details of my life are quite inconsequential. Okay, where do I begin? My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium.
Anyways, after that open mic night at the comedy club in Boston in 2001, Ryan Dempster didn't get back on the stage, at least not for a while. In 2004, he signed with the Cubs, which got him to Chicago, a city famous for its comedy scene. That, Ryan says, was just a coincidence. But he did continue telling jokes and doing impersonations for his teammates. In 2013, he won a World Series with the Red Sox. And then, after 16 MLB seasons, he retired.
Once I got done, I really had the vision of the late-night talk show.
That's when Ryan joined that improv class where his classmates wondered if he'd fallen on financial hardship. He also returned to stand-up. At first, Ryan says he was hesitant to talk about his baseball career on stage. He even performed at open mics under an alias.
But one of my friends, Andy Engel, who runs the Gotham Comedy Club, he's like, share those. Like, you have experiences that those other comedians don't.
So Ryan started joking about baseball. And meanwhile, he built up his experience on TV by working as an analyst for MLB Network. And then in August 2018, Ryan debuted Off the Mound, his own late-night style show.
It's Off the Mound with Ryan Dempster!
Off the Mound features a live band, interviews with baseball players and other celebrities, and, of course, Ryan telling jokes.
For anybody who doesn't know where Canada is, it's just right above the U.S. on a map. Just America's hat, that's right.
That's Ryan hosting Off the Mound at the Cubs convention this past January.
I remember my first year ever playing professional baseball, and this guy on my team says, "Man, you're from Canada. Wow. What's that like, playing baseball in Canada?" And I was like, you know, it's pretty much the same, I gotta admit. Got to call timeout and go to the dugouts when the polar bears go through, but other than that.
Ryan calls the show his own fun little take on Johnny Carson. At first, Off the Mound was only a live event. Then it was also streamed on the internet. But this year, it moved onto the regional Marquee Sports Network, which broadcasts Cubs games. Because of the pandemic, Ryan hasn't been able to film in front of an audience, but he's still putting out episodes from home.
Just grab those two little feet of the bunny you got there, and I got the
on
baby.
The TV premiere this past April, Ryan used a doll to teach three-time AL MVP and father-to-be Mike Trout how to change a diaper.
And you just pull up just a little bit on their legs so that see how the butt gets off there?
There is a comedian who said laughter. I think it might have been Jim Gaffigan. He said, "I believe that laughter is the best medicine after you get real medicine." You know, and it's true. If we can give a little bit of laughter and a little bit of levity, you know, then I think that's really important.
More than three decades since he started watching Johnny Carson on the couch with his dad, Ryan Dempster is now in the host seat himself. He says he knows he's still got a lot to learn, but it seems like he's right where he's supposed to be.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kassler. We'll have more info on how to find Off the Mound with Ryan Dempster at onlyagame.org. The night before the 1971 MLB All-Star Game, Diane K. Shaw went to a dinner for sports writers, but the man at the door told her the event was for men only.
And I said, "Tell me, are there going to be naked women jumping out of cakes? Are they going to tell dirty jokes?"
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. In July of 1971, Diane K. Shaw arrived in Detroit for the MLB All-Star Game. As far as she knew, she was the first female sports writer ever to cover that event. She checked into her hotel and picked up her credentials, and she was handed a goodie bag.
And it was all men's stuff, you know, razor blades, razors, tie clips. I thought it was kind of funny, but anyway, there was this envelope, and I opened it up, and it said there would be a dinner that night at 6 o'clock for sports writers and baseball players. And I thought, oh, great, saved. I don't have to eat in my room.
So a few minutes after six, Diane went down to the ballroom.
Most of the tables were still pretty empty, but as I stepped in, this man blocked me, and he said, "I'm sorry, Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going in here for the baseball writers' dinner." And he said, "No, women aren't allowed. You must be in the wrong place." I said, "No, I'm in the right place." So we began this little battle, and he was determined to keep me out. He said, "It's a stag event." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Tell me, are there going to be naked women jumping out of cakes? Are they going to tell dirty jokes?" And he got all upset. No, of course not. It's just..." So, meanwhile, all these men were allowed to just walk in. And I started to turn away to go back up to my room. And all of a sudden, this voice, I don't know where it came from. It came from me, but I just found myself saying to him, "Well, I'm going in. You will have to bodily remove me." And I walked in the room. And I expected somebody, him or somebody else, to yank my arm and pull me out, but nobody did.
Diane stopped at the first table she came to. It was empty, except for Cincinnati Reds catcher and future Baseball Hall of Famer Johnny Bench.
I'd met him a couple times, and I said, hi, Johnny, do you remember me? Can I join you? And he said, of course, sit down. So I did. It turned out to be a very boring dinner. It wasn't worth the trouble I'd gone through to even get in. Bobby Goldsboro, the singer, country singer, was Johnny's guest, and then there were two other sports writers. And when the dinner ended, Johnny Bench said, hey, you know, I've got beer up in my room. Why don't you all come on up? So we did.
When her All-Star Game report appeared in the National Observer a few days later, Diane started by setting the scene in Johnny Bench's hotel room the night before the game.
Goldsboro wound up in a dark corner strumming his guitar as accompaniment for who else? Bench.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
Bellowed the catcher, who wouldn't know what it's like to be not.
When you're hot, you're hot.
And that was one of my first instances of, like, did I break down a barrier? I don't know what I did, but I did get in.
Would I be wrong to see this as sort of a theme of your life, pushing your way through doors that are not exactly open to you?
I never thought of it that way, but you could be right, especially when it came to reporting. I always somehow tried to find a way to get what I needed. I had a summer job at a newspaper, and I would sit there with my hand on the phone for 10 minutes before I could pick it up and make a phone call. But when you're a reporter, you're on deadline. You have to produce the story, and you have competition, and you don't want them to have a better story. So I think that makes you do things that in ordinary life you wouldn't.
Okay, so let's skip to the fall of 1972. The Boston Red Sox were in a race for the pennant, and you were accused of destroying the American family. Explain, please.
Yes, one of my worst failed attempts. I don't think I succeeded there. But yes, I was working for the National Observer newspaper, a weekly paper published by Dow Jones.
A few years earlier, Diane had been one of the first female journalists ever hired by Dow Jones. She wasn't a full-time sports writer. She covered everything from the Republican National Convention to New York Fashion Week. And the paper allowed her to write about sports, a lifelong passion, whenever she wanted. So in the fall of 1972, Diane called the Red Sox to request credentials to 6 home games. She says she spoke with a man named Bill Crowley, she would call him Super Flack in her story, who told her that the Red Sox didn't allow women into the press box or on the field or into the dugout.
In fact, Crowley had told me, he said, you know, we let one girl in here and it was a disaster. Turned out this reporter from the Waukegan News Sun had been in the press box and a foul ball had hit her on the shoulder. I mean, I don't think that was her fault, but that was a disaster. They didn't want to have another disaster.
Diane was persistent, and at the end of the week, just 2 hours before game time, she was granted access. Diane was on the field for batting practice when she was pulled away by Crowley's assistant, who insisted on giving her a tour of Fenway Park.
Basically, to get me away from the players. So we go up to the roof. You probably know this, Karen, unless they've changed it, but that's where the press lounge was. And he took me up there. Right outside the door to go in was a wrought iron table with one place setting and a sign that said, Ladies Pavilion. And he said, you can have dinner here. I said, I don't think I'm hungry, thank you. And then he opened the door to the press lounge and he said, you can't go in here. Except, and he pointed down the hall to a door with a sign that said, ladies. He said, you can use the bathroom, that's all. I said, oh, okay.
Finally, Diane was led into the press box, where she was seated near Bill Crowley, a.k.a. Super Flack, who spent the first few innings ignoring her.
Finally, I introduced myself, and he said, see what you've done? Tomorrow there'll be 50 girls here saying that they're reporters. And I said, well, I don't think there's 50 female sports writers in the country, sir. And he said, no, but they'll say they are just to get to my boys. And then a little while later, he said to me that I was probably going to destroy the American family.
By week's end, they had all pretty much come around. When I didn't show up for one game, I was sitting in the stands with my husband, Super Flack actually remarked, "Where's that girl? She's been good luck. Get her up here." Perhaps the American family will survive after all.
Probably every profession, it's the same situation. It's just, hey, we've never had women around here before. We don't know what to do with you. But somehow, I always thought it was funny. I didn't take it too seriously because all I really wanted was to get my story. And as long as I could get my story, you know, I didn't care.
In 1981, you took a job with the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and became the first female sports columnist for a daily paper, or at least that's what they said. So I don't want to imply that it was only men who didn't know what to do with you. Tell me about Georgia Frontieri, the majority owner of the Rams from 79 to 2008.
Ah, yes, Georgia. Georgia became owner of the then Los Angeles Rams when her husband, Carol Rosenblum, drowned.
When Diane took the job in L.A., she was welcomed into the Dodgers clubhouse and the Lakers locker room. But when she called and requested access to the Rams, Georgia said no.
I don't remember that I told my editor. I mean, I just figured, okay, I'll get what I need. I'll figure it out somehow. So that Friday night, I was at the Lakers game. It was before the game started. I got a phone call from the editor of the Herald Examiner, and he said, "Oh, by the way, we just sued the Rams on your behalf. I'm putting a reporter on the phone to interview you. It's going to be page one tomorrow." And I was really upset because I didn't want to be involved in a lawsuit. I didn't think it would be helpful. And I kind of prided myself at that point on figuring out how to solve my own problems.
The next day, during an emergency court hearing, the Rams declared that all reporters, both male and female, would be barred from the locker room. Instead, players would be brought into a separate interview room. When Diane arrived at the stadium the next day, it was clear that some of her fellow sports writers weren't happy with this new arrangement.
Anyway, the game ends, and we're shepherded down into the bowels of the stadium, into this concrete room with folding chairs. And at the back of the room are two, like, aluminum tables covered with white tablecloth. And on these tables are bottles of liquor and wine, some soft drinks, beer, and two bartenders. So the reporters walk in, and they see this, and they go, "What? Are you kidding me? We're on deadline. We're not partying." So all the anger towards me now went back to Georgia. They were furious with her. It was an insult.
My favorite story of you opening doors that were not supposed to be open to you has nothing at all to do with your gender. The year was 1985, and the door in question was the door to the White House. Tell me that story.
Yes. So what happened was, the Lakers had finally beat the Celtics for the NBA championship up in Boston.
President Reagan invited the team to the White House, and Diane and the rest of the writers tagged along. But when they got to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, a guard met the writers at the bus and told them their names weren't on the list and they wouldn't be allowed in.
So some of the reporters jump off the bus and, "Oh, no, we're here for the Lakers." And he says, "No, I don't have your name." I got off the bus, too. And I had covered things at the White House years before, and I knew there were two entrances on Pennsylvania Avenue. So I take off, I run to the other one, and there's a guard there. And before he can stop me, I just ran right past him. I held up my press pass. "I'm with the Lakers," I said, and I kept running. So I'm wandering around the White House looking for the Lakers, and I finally found them. And I wrote a story. Nobody else wrote that story because nobody else figured out how to get in.
Is there a lesson that you take from all the doors you've broken down?
Yes. And I don't want anybody to take this wrong, but we all have problems. I don't care what job you have, or even if you don't have a job, problems come with life. And I always thought if you could figure out your own way to solve your own problem, I found that when I did solve my own problems, it empowered me. It gave me such a great feeling that, hey, I did this. I did it myself. I didn't sue anybody except that one time when my paper did. And I think that that's something that's super important to be able to know. You're not going to win every time, no, but I think you can win a lot more than you think you can.
Diane K. Shaw is the author of A Farewell to Arms, Legs, and Jockstraps, a sports writer's memoir. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Before I let you go, I'm hoping you can help introduce our next story. It's a piece you wrote in 1983 about former Philadelphia Phillies pitcher Steve Carlton. So I'm hoping you can kind of set it up.
It was the 1980 World Series between the Philadelphia Phillies and Kansas City. Steve Carlton at that time was one of the best pitchers in baseball. He'd won 4 Cy Young Awards. He won Game 2 of that World Series, I think spectacularly. And so after the game, we were in the locker room hoping to interview him. Steve Carlton was known as a guy that didn't get interviewed. He was a jerk. I'm sorry, he was a jerk. Anyway, but there were 4 of us, and Steve Carlton was in a glassed-in office not far from us, and he was just looking at us, glaring at us, and we were standing there hoping he'd come out. All of a sudden, this other guy, Dickie Knowles, he was, I don't know, not a very good pitcher, he comes out and throws a bucket of water on us. As he does this, Carlton races out of this office down the hall into a trainer's room and slams the door. So, 3 years later, Phillies came to Dodger Stadium for the first round of the playoffs, and I sharpened my pencil and wrote my revenge.
We're going to give that column a double play. That's what we call our occasional series, where we turn a newspaper column or book chapter into a radio drama.
Having recently passed a statistical benchmark, that is, having just written my 300th column, I find I am besieged by athletes begging me to interview them. I know that only 15 other sports columnists in the history of journalism have reached this plateau, but I must say this constant round of interviews does grow wearisome. Every time a new team comes to town, it's the same thing. You'd think all the athletes could just get together and agree to one mass interview. To make matters worse, I again find myself covering the playoffs. So now the requests for interviews have intensified all the more. Yesterday morning, no sooner had I reached my office when the phone rang.
Yeah?
Miss Shaw, this is Steve Carlton with the Philadelphia Phillies. I was wondering if you'd,
I haven't even had my coffee yet. Don't you guys ever sleep?
I'm sorry,
Carlton said.
It's just that I was wondering if you would have time today to interview me.
Yeah, what team did you say you were from?
The Phillies. I'm a pitcher.
All right, I remember. Haven't I interviewed you before? When the Phillies won the 1980 World Series, or after you got your 300th win? I mean, I'm sure I did.
Actually, you didn't. I was rather hoping you would, but you always walk right past me. I've even sent you notes requesting interviews, but you never reply.
You know how many games there are in a season?
Yes. But I felt I had to give it a shot.
So, what is it you want me to interview you about?
I said, trying not to sound bored.
Well, you could ask me about my tough conditioning program. The kung fu and pushing my arm into a tub of rice, or how many more years I'm going to pitch, or what I think about the playoffs.
Same old stuff,
I said, stifling a yawn.
You'd think occasionally one of you guys would come up with something new to say.
I did lead the league in strikeouts with 275.
Are you a Cy Young candidate then?
No,
he said sadly.
That would be John Denny. He pitches Wednesday night.
Don't take this personally, but readers would probably be more interested in finding out what he has to say.
I wouldn't need much time, although I usually like as much time with the writer as possible.
Yeah, I've heard that before. You athletes think the longer the interview, the better the story. Only I'm not getting paid to shoot the breeze with you guys. I get paid to write a column. I know it's important to your line of work to get interviewed, so I try to accommodate you when I can. But it's not on my contract here at the paper to just sit around doing interviews all day.
I'll try to be as brief as possible. Perhaps we could have lunch or a cup of coffee before the game.
Absolutely not! You want me to talk to you? We'll talk at the ballpark. I hate it when athletes try to interfere with my private life.
Fine. What time should I meet you?
Well, let's see. I'll get to Dodger Stadium about 2.5 hours before the game. Then I have to go up to the press box and set up my word processing machine. This is a special time for me. I don't like to be rushed.
How about after you finish word processing practice?
No, because then I like to stroll around the batting cage, chatting with my colleagues from the other papers. It's really annoying when an athlete comes over and interrupts. Some of the best jokes I hear are said at the batting cage.
After that?
No. Next, I have to stop in Tom Lasorda's office. I need to check out the food and which celebrities have come by.
Gee, this is really important to me.
Tell you what. I'll send an intermediary. I'll get Vin Scully to interview you. I'll give the tape to Steve Brenner, the Dodger publicist, and he'll screen the best answers out.
I really appreciate this.
Sure. By the way, what did you say your name was?
That's Oh No, Not Another Boring Interview with Steve Carlton by Diane K. Shaw. It was first published in the Los Angeles Herald Examiner on October 4th, 1983, and it's been reprinted many, many times since then. It appears here with permission from Hearst Communications, Inc. Big thanks to our actors Taylor Pendleton Harris and Alex Schneps. In 2017, filmmaker Brett Rapkin began interviewing Olympic athletes about their mental health.
Every single athlete I've talked to have been not just willing, but enthusiastic about telling me that we need more help.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Doesn't love a good story. On Circle Round, the storytelling podcast from WBUR, we adapt folk tales from around the world as radio plays, featuring beloved stars of the stage and screen, like Seinfeld's Jason Alexander, Hamilton star Philippa Sue, and Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Award winner Billy Porter. Circle Round has been named a top kids podcast by the New York Times, Good Housekeeping, and Time Magazine, and we think you'll love it too. Find Circle Round wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the story of a 1904 steamboat disaster, an athlete's performance in front of the British royal family, and the origin of modern women's swimwear. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
I don't know about you, but I am tired of all the bad news. So I'm going to start with what just might be the best news of the week, if not the whole year. The NHL franchise set to begin play in Seattle in 2021 has a name, and that name is?
The Kraken! Release the Kraken from the sea!
You have to give a big shout out to the promotion department for a really mediocre Liam Neeson movie. For embedding Release the Kraken into all of our consciousness. I mean, I don't know three people who've actually seen that movie, but everybody knows the line.
In other franchise name news, the NFL team from Washington, D.C. will be known as the Washington Football Team until a more permanent rebranding can be completed. You know how I like to criticize this team, Charlie, but I think rushing into a new name would have been a bad idea, and I'm all for giving people something to call this team that's not a racial slur. You?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Karen, that generics are just as good as brand names in so many ways. What they really should do is they should take all insignia off the uniform and just go with white uniforms and red uniforms with gold numbers. And then, you know, just like, you know, one of those plain white jugs that says orange juice on it.
Or government cheese.
Exactly.
Government cheese.
You're exactly right. Yes.
While the Atlanta Braves have declined to change their name and the Kansas City Chiefs have declined to comment, Paul Dolan, owner of the Cleveland Indians, says he's open to a name change. He says the team will be meeting with Native American leaders to get their perspective, and he feels a real, quote, sense of urgency around this. I mean, he's saying all the right things. Do you believe he's sincere?
I believe he's 60% sincere, sure. I believe the meetings will happen. I don't believe that they will be renamed the Kraken, much to my disappointment. I dread the possibility that the nickname might have something to do with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Charlie, the opening game of the 2020 MLB season is in the books. The New York Yankees beat the defending champion Washington Nationals 4-1 in a rain-shortened five-inning game. Dr. Anthony Fauci threw out the first pitch, and let's just say he's a better scientist than he is a pitcher. Are you happy to have baseball back?
Yeah, I mean, it's live sports on TV. And, you know, it's the best we can do at the moment. I am not optimistic that the full season will get played. But I did think that Dr. Fauci, as a scientist, did provide a pretty definitive proof that gravity works. If you throw the ball directly at the earth, it will hit the ground.
The WNBA will also return to play this weekend. As you know, the league was primed for a big year with a new collective bargaining agreement and the addition of former Oregon superstar Sabrina Ionescu. Will you be watching from home, of course?
I'm really excited to see what she can do in the pros. Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got the WNBA and the NBA playing at the same time. So that'll be an interesting experiment in television ratings. The NBA and the WNBA have really established a very good modus vivendi that helps both particular leagues. This will be a real test of that.
And finally, Charlie, Torino, the Serie A team in Torino, has a plan to make fans safer once they're allowed back in. It's called Feel Safe, and it's basically a big metal gate that takes fans' temperatures and uses facial recognition to make sure they're wearing a mask properly. It can even squirt fans with disinfectants. Ugh. They're now testing it out on journalists. Can I sign you up?
Of course they're testing it out on journalists. We're everybody's guinea pigs. I mean, it's actually a good idea. At this point, I'm not going to oppose anything that keeps the fans safe. I'm not sure about the being sprayed with disinfectants, though.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
I'm Karen Given. A few years ago, independent filmmaker Brett Rapkin started noticing blurred vision in his left eye. At first, he thought it was no big deal, but it turned out he was suffering from keratoconus, a degenerative eye condition that, in severe cases, requires a cornea transplant. Rapkin's search for a less invasive treatment led him to a story he needed to tell about Olympic athletes and mental health. And just a quick warning, this story includes conversations about suicide. Here's reporter Tal Pinchevsky.
Brett Rapkin's search for treatment of his keratoconus eventually brought him to the office of Dr. Brian Boxer Wachler. A specialist based in Beverly Hills, Dr. Boxer Wachler had pioneered a treatment known as the Holcomb C3R procedure.
He had used this procedure on Stephen Holcomb, who had become legally blind while being the captain of the U.S. bobsled team. He had Stephen's book in his waiting room, which is called But Now I See, and I would read it in chunks while I was waiting for my appointment, and I was blown away by the story.
Here's the story as NBC told it at the 2010 Vancouver Olympics.
Steve Holcomb is about 51 seconds away from erasing 62 years of frustration.
The United States hadn't won a gold medal in the four-man bobsled since 1948. Bobsled is a team event, but during the broadcast, it was clear the focus was on the face of the U.S. bobsled program, driver Stephen Holcomb.
He got through 50-50 clean, 93 miles per hour.
But it was the story of what happened before Holcomb's historic gold medal that most fascinated Brett Rapkin. In 2007, Holcomb attempted to kill himself by ingesting 73 sleeping pills and washing them down with a bottle of Jack Daniels. Rapkin had his next film idea.
Our plan was to tell the inspiring story of a guy who had survived that, miraculously woken up, gotten his legal blindness fixed, and won a gold medal.
Rapkin reached out to the Olympic champion, and Holcomb agreed to an interview.
He showed up to the interview. He was an incredibly friendly guy, soft-spoken, doesn't look like your typical Olympian, kind of stocky. We had dinner in Santa Monica, chatted for a bit, and the next day we did the interview. It lasted, I want to say, close to 3 hours, and there were some pretty emotional moments.
Holcomb talked about what it was like to have been losing his eyesight while still competing. He actually kept the condition secret, knowing that it could potentially cost him his career.
It's scary, and I had to withdraw from my friends and my family and society in general, and just really kind of became closed off, and I kind of slipped into a depression knowing that this was inevitable and it was going to happen.
He was putting himself and his teammates' lives at risk every time he drove down the bobsled course. You combine that with his own mental health challenges that are probably genetic, and it became an unbearable situation for him.
Just made sense to me. I mean, it just made sense that if I just end it now, it solves so many problems and everything will just get better. And I'll be doing people a favor. They won't waste their money on me. They're not going to waste their time. And then my eyes are going bad. Like, I don't want to go blind. So I just kind of, killing 10 birds with one stone. And it just seemed like, to me, it was completely logical and it made sense. And that's what's scary about depression is that stuff does make sense. And you just end up doing crazy things. So I ended up, I had a whole bunch of sleeping pills on hand. That should have worked. I don't know why it didn't work. It should have worked. And maybe there's something else I meant to do.
We talked about that, at length, and he was quite emotional, in particular, talking about how it would have affected his mom and his family if he hadn't survived his attempt. And he talked about how grateful he was to have survived and that he could tell his story.
After the gold medal in 2010, Holcomb went on to win 2 bronze medals in Sochi. When he sat down with Rapkin, Holcomb was just 10 months away from going to South Korea for what he expected would be his last Olympic Games. He'd been competing for the U.S. since 1998 and didn't know what he was going to do next.
After he went to Pyeongchang, he was going to have to move into his mom's basement and figure out the rest of his life. That was his headspace a few months out from the Winter Games. And 12 days later, I got a call from his longtime agent that he was dead.
On May 6, 2017, Holcomb was found dead in his room at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Lake Placid, New York. He was 37. A preliminary report from the local coroner found a lethal combination of alcohol and sleeping pills in his system.
There was no indication to me that he wanted to harm himself. He was excited about teammates that were returning. He was excited about some new equipment that he had gotten for his bobsled. He had so much that he was looking forward to. And his family and friends feel very strongly that his death was not intentional. So we may never know exactly how he died, but we know that he was someone who had suffered.
As we cheer for these young men and young women, as we become fascinated in their personal journeys and their stories, I think it's also important to recognize their humanity.
This is Dr. Scott Goldman. He is a licensed clinical psychologist and the director of the Performance Psychology Center at the University of Michigan. In more than a decade of working with athletes, Dr. Goldman has seen firsthand the unique challenges facing Olympians, who remain mostly anonymous except for a 2-week window that comes every 4 years.
What you see is just a roller coaster ride, right? Like, it is training hard, world championships, training hard, Olympic trials, training hard, Olympic events. And that roller coaster is an onslaught on the senses. They are just going, 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 going. And then when it ends quickly. I think many of them are really just exhausted and they just need a recovery period.
After Holcomb's death, Brett Rapkin decided to expand his project, to speak to other Olympic athletes about their struggles with depression and the after effects of competition. And soon, athletes started reaching out to him.
So I basically got on the phone with Brett. I just thought this was such an important story.
That's Sasha Cohen. She won silver in ladies figure skating in Torino. And while she's never been diagnosed with depression, she's experienced the pressures of being an Olympian. That pressure only intensified heading into those 2006 games, where she was considered a medal contender following her Olympic debut in 2002.
It's really difficult. I remember one summer, it was the 4th of July, I went with my trainer to the track where we did sprints, and I just knew that my family and my friends, they were all, you know, on a beach in California, like having a barbecue and being social and watching fireworks. And I was in the midst of like 100-degree summer, just feeling so nauseous from the sprints and so alone. My mom was a big support for me, so I would call her. You know, I think on that day I called her crying, and I was like, I don't want to be here, and like, why am I here, and this is so hard. There are moments like that. There are so many moments like that when you're training, but you tell yourself it's fine, it's just today.
But Cohen's most challenging moments came after she stepped away from the ice. After dedicating her life to her Olympic pursuit, she enrolled at Columbia University in search of a new purpose.
You know, I went to a career fair at Columbia, and I checked out every booth and employer and tried to get a feel for what the jobs were, what I'd be doing, trying to imagine myself there. It was strange, you know. I was 30, everyone else was 20, 21, and it's just a very different life from what I'd come from.
Sasha Cohen is just one of the Olympic athletes who have told Rapkin their story. He's also spoken to former Olympic skier and NFL player Jeremy Bloom, as well as swimming legend Michael Phelps, who has been very open about his own struggles with depression since retiring from the pool as the most decorated athlete in Olympic history.
Every single athlete I've talked to, some of who still have strong affiliations to the USOC, have been not just willing, but enthusiastic about telling me that we need more help. Steven was roughly my age. You know, he was in his late 30s. It's bizarre. You know, I mean, I had dinner with the guy. I spent an entire day working with him, talking with him. We went and filmed his eye doctor checkup. It's still totally shocking that he's not around.
That story came to us from reporter Tal Pinchevsky. It first aired in February of 2018. Brett Rapkin's documentary, The Weight of Gold, premieres on HBO this coming Wednesday, July 29th. And if you or someone you know might need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.